From WHQR Public Radio in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. People in New Hanover County are getting fatter, and this is not a body image issue. It's an issue that's leading to chronic disease and early death. 60% of New Hanover County residents, according to a study published early last year, this is based on self-reported data, 60% are either overweight or obese. When the data is broken down according to race, a sad but all too predictable picture emerges. 58% of white people fall into the overweight obese category, but people of color in New Hanover County report much higher numbers. 76% of African American residents, 80% of Asian respondents, and 88% of Native Americans have a weight problem. We'll unpack those numbers on today's edition of Coastline and find out what they really tell us, including why there's a marked gap between the general health of people of color and those who identify as white. We'll also find out why a recently published report from the Department of Public Health at East Carolina University, which examined social determinants of health, concludes that more than 5,500 deaths in North Carolina could be avoided if everyone had a fair chance to be healthy. With us today for a tour of these issues and the local public health landscape is the health director for New Hanover County. Philip Tart took the helm of the health department after longtime director David Rice retired last year. He's been in the job for less than a year, about 8 months, but already has some pretty clear ideas about how he plans to shake up the county's collective health outlook. Philip Tart, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you.
And we're inviting your questions on this Thursday. Now is your chance to ask a public health expert. Are there issues you think local officials are not talking about that they should be talking about? You can reach us on this Thursday at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. Philip Tart, that data from this particular study that was done in New Hanover County, there are some pretty high and shocking numbers there. Can you sort of give us a perspective for those numbers? This was self-reported data.
Yeah, so let me begin by saying what we do when we have a community health assessment that's conducted every 4 years is we have two data sets, a primary data set where we try to collect data from individuals based on their beliefs, attitudes, self-reported data, as you said. We pair that against secondary data, which is actually the data that we get from not only behavioral risk factor surveillance system surveys, hospital data, CDC data, accurate information. We pair the two and try to combine those. So the self-reported data based on height and weight predictions with BMI, yeah, it was at that 60 percentile in that report. What I had reported on 2 months ago is it's probably in the 20 to 25, maybe 30% range. I would say right at 25% is where I was. If you average children and adults.
And when you say 20, 25%, you're talking about all the residents in New Hanover County.
We're talking everyone.
Okay, yes. Overweight or obese.
Overweight or obese. But either way, whether it's 60 or 30, it's significant.
Why does the self-reported data skew so high?
I think simply because if someone's answering a question or if you don't have a really good representation of the community, you can do that. That's why we want to assure that we have as random a sample as you could possibly have. And you know, CHAs are typically done that way. This one just happened to be too high. Not to say it's incorrect. It was just within that data set that we had. But when we do this data, we want to make sure we have representation from every single community, every street, every zip code, if you will, to ensure that that we're representing the entirety of the community. And then we want to take that data particularly and pare it down to those areas to see where our hot spots are.
Okay, and we're going to get out of the geeky data world in just a second. But first, can you put data in perspective, statistics in perspective for us? You have a story about some deer hunters who also happen to be statisticians.
I did. So I had a statistics professor in college that said, let's talk about statistics because they can mean different things to different people. And he said, we were deer hunting one day, and he said, I was with one statistician friend. He shot a foot to the left, missed. My next data system friend shot to the right, missed by a foot, missed. And he said, why do I need to shoot? I think statistically we hit him. So it's really a law of averages. But what we want to make sure of is that we don't just give statistics that paint the picture we want to paint. It has to be represented because there's a finite amount of resources. There's a finite amount of effort that you have, and you want to make sure you pinpoint that exactly where the problems are. So it benefits us greatly in this community and in this region to make sure that this data is correct. So that's how we look at data. We want to make sure it's there. We don't want to skew it to present a picture that we want. It has to be the accurate picture.
So then how much of the population that is overweight and obese, the causes of death are different. You don't see obesity on a death certificate.
You don't.
And so how do you link overweight and obese to causes of death?
So if we look statistically, and I'll use that word, we know through the past 40, 50 years, the diseases that obesity can cause or as a contributing factor to. So that's not a made up statistic. So if we have cardiovascular disease and there are no other indicating factors, or you have somebody that has type 2 diabetes as a result of an adult onset as a cause of obesity, it's those factors that they actually die from. But somewhere down in that medical record, you can look at that BMI and you can look at that contributing factor and you can determine, oh, wait a minute, yeah, they had heart disease, they had diabetes, but they didn't have it, and let's look at that lifestyle that they led prior to. We know obesity is the number one leading cause, preventable cause of much of this illness in the country, without hands down.
Much of what illness?
Death. We talk about cardiovascular disease. We talk about diabetes. If you curbed obesity, and we talk about type 2 diabetes, where obesity is the number one cause of type 2 diabetes. If you could just get that down, statistically, type 2 diabetes might not fade into the distance. There's some other contributing factors, but it would certainly not be in that top 10 list.
ECU published this analysis. It looks like it was pretty recent, last month, that analyzes social determinants as they correlate to health outcomes. It draws a pretty bold line between poverty and health. What is the connection between social problems and health outcomes?
So what we find is that some of the terminology we use is a zip code can determine your health outcomes. If you don't have access to social cohesion or civic participation, or you're impoverished, or you're in an environment where learning is not priority, or you don't have access to health care or primary care or lack of insurance, those are the social determinants that can impact you long term. And we know that. If you don't seek health care, let's say we have, I think, recently published a 12% uninsured in New Hanover County. Do the math. We got 200,000 people, 11%. Let's say it's 20,000 people that seek health care as a last resort.
When something's already happened,
and that cost has already escalated at that point. And typically, there's no prevention mechanism within that self-care that they have. So, yeah.
Can you give us an example of that?
Specifically,
yeah.
So
a person who doesn't have health insurance.
So if an individual, we'll take that as one of the social determinants. They have no insurance. They decide that maybe I've got an abscess tooth. I have no dental insurance, but I'm going to put this off. Frankly, I'm making $40,000 as a family unit. I really cannot afford anything but the house payment and the groceries. I put off the dental situation. It becomes abscessed. At that point, my diet changes, and we see that. Then you have a malnutrition situation. So there's all of the, and particularly in a child, so there's all of these various components that can lead to individuals' long-term chronic conditions. The other one is access to foods. We always talk about that, food deserts. Yeah, there's plenty of fat. There's plenty of let's say, corner stores. But what we find is corner stores don't necessarily pack the most nutritious items, but they're easily accessible. And if I don't have transportation or if I don't have means to buy those fresh fruits and vegetables, as we talked about, then my next best guess is to buy that processed material that's readily available to me. And it's not the most nutritious. Now, I do that over long term. So now I've developed potentially developed obesity and or gained some non-nutritional value over the course of a long period of time. So, you know, it's access to food. So it's a myriad of things. It's basically having it's not necessarily an equity quality, but it's having access to all of those things that you typically wouldn't, to put you on that level playing field to ensure that your health can be the best it can be.
What can a public health director do about some of those things?
So for me the county, and I think we really are gaining some good momentum, and it's certainly not me. I cannot do this by myself, and I don't intend to. That's a terrible way to say that, but I mean, it's a community effort is what I'm trying to say. And we have some really good partnerships with community members. What we can do collectively is pinpoint these items that we need to work on and tackle them together. Again, limited resources, limited time, limited people.
And we're going to hear more about that, some of the collaborative ideas that you have, when we come back from this break. You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM, talking with Philip Tart, New Hanover County's health director. Since he took the reins last August, we're learning about what he's observed so far and what the health goals need to be for this region. And he's taking your questions on this Thursday. You can reach us today at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. The phone lines are open. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Philip Tart is the health director for New Hanover County. He's brought with him a passel of analyses that illustrate why local residents are dying sooner than they probably should. And he's exploring with us how behaviors are often impacted by policy, poverty, and other social determinants. If you have a question for Philip Tart, you can call us on this Thursday at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. We are going to get into collaborative efforts with other agencies in a little while, but first I want to get to this email from Bob Parr. He writes, earlier this month, the American Lung Association State of the Air report ranked Wilmington as one of the top cities in the United States for clean air. This was also reported, I think, by the Wilmington Star News. He writes, clean air does not just happen. In the past, when a local cement plant made plans to open in Castle Hayne, 18,000 citizens, 250 medical care providers, and 5 environmental groups worked for 8 years to protect the air quality of New Hanover County. Both the New Hanover Pender Medical Society and the New Hanover County Board of Health directly assisted in these matters. The air emissions permit for the cement plant, if enacted, would have increased our present air emissions by 40%. And I don't want to get into the entire breakdown that he lists here. It's doubtful that Wilmington would, he says, would be on the list of clean air cities today without the hard work to protect air quality. What do you think about the health impacts of air pollution on public health?
Well, and I appreciate the comment. He's right. That air, as I said, air, water, and soil, clean soil, to me are imperative, particularly clean air. I mean, if you can honestly say that, you know what, your impact on this environmental concern impacts me as well across the street. So that is one of the things that we can honestly come to an agreement on. But yeah, they came back and the American Lung Association put Wilmington, New Hanover County in the top 25, tops in the state. I think a lot of that has to do with It does have to do with the proactivity of the coal burning. Coal contributes a lot of pollutants to air.
You're talking about Duke Energy coal burning plant to the natural gas.
Mm-hmm. I think that had a lot to do. They studied five things. I think they were particulates and CO2 emissions, and the list goes on. But a lot of that contribution actually comes from that and from manufacturing. So I don't know. Time will tell. I think it's a great result, but it's only the start. It's a snapshot in time. We want to ensure that continues. So it does take that kind of proactivity, and I appreciate him doing that. And I think it does take a lot of hard work. And I don't think that's anything any of us wouldn't agree upon, whether bureaucracy, policy. We agree clean air is very important. That was a great study they did. It really was.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking with Philip Tart. He's health director for New Hanover County. And you can ask your own question on this Thursday by calling us at 910-343-1138. You can email us at coastline@whqr.org. I want to get back to some of the social determinants of health outcomes for a moment. You looked at child poverty a little bit in New Hanover County, and you compared that to Orange County, which is a little more central near Durham, and Buncombe County in the western part of the state. And then you also looked at North Carolina as a whole. Why, first of all, do you tease out child poverty as a separate health issue?
So for us, children in poverty are just the beginning of their life. And what you really are determining, are they in a good social setting to learn? They are the future of the country. So if you can have these interventions for them, whether it be their thought process of how they're going to live their lives going forward, or you can intervene on healthy foods and backpack programs, and it's getting them prepared for life at their most vulnerable state. So we tease it out because they are extremely important. And another component is that long-term healthcare costs. So if you catch these early, you're spending less later. And I think those two are important. At the end of the future, and it's that spending. But ultimately, you want to make sure that they are as healthy as they can be because of those two factors.
Was I looking at this graph correctly? It looked like there was more child poverty than adult poverty.
I think they can go hand in hand. It just depends how the statistics could be calculated. It depends on the number of children within the household unit. So you could have two adults in the household unit and four children. So unless that is adjusted, age adjusted, and or household size adjusted, you typically might see a higher number for children.
So then, by that snapshot, in all of the counties in North Carolina as a whole, there was more child poverty than just general.
You can see, yes. I think that's what that statistic told us. Yes.
There's also, you brought up the cost of healthcare, and. There's a graph. I said we'd get away from some of the wonkiness, but it's interesting what the data really tells you. And this graph shows the correlation between healthcare spending and life expectancy around the globe. And it's shocking, because one of the notable points is that the U.S. by far spends the most on healthcare, and yet is below more than 30 other countries in terms of life expectancy, including much of Western Europe, the South Pacific, Japan. It's shocking.
It's most
What's
of
going
all,
on
all
there?
Of the industrialized countries. So I looked this up. The year I was born, the total healthcare spending in this country was $75 billion, and this is based on Kaiser information and healthcare. It's $356 a person. Last year, if you'll look at this now, I'm 46, so 46 years later, we're spending close to $3 trillion on health care. And this stat says $9,086 per person on health care. But you're right, and the health outcomes aren't even close to some of these other countries. Right now, you're looking at about 20% of the gross domestic product going towards health care spending. And it's not to say that primary care is not necessary. I mean, we provide primary care in public health as well. There's always going to be a need for that. What our effort is how do we put more emphasis on the prevention?
Is that the difference? Is that why the U.S. has such a low life expectancy compared to comparable?
Philip Tarte's personal opinion, and what we've seen is it's lifestyle. So we have a higher spending, which should equate to better health, but we also have more sedentary lifestyles. We drive long distances to work. We sit all day. Our food consumption is different, and those studies have been looked at for 30 years. They've been conducted. So it's different lifestyle eases that we currently live with. When you look at some of these other countries, some of them tend to be more mobile, foot traffic, walk to the store. It's not all of it, but it's some of it. But we do tend to lead a more sedentary lifestyle. I know I do.
We had a call. Lisa from Wilmington asks if you're familiar with the pilot program called Plant Pure Nation, launched in Mebane, North Carolina. They monitored people on a plant-based diet, and all the participants had a low impact exercise program, such as walking. They were monitored by healthcare professionals. Blood pressure, blood sugar, et cetera, was measured. People saw drastic drops in those numbers as well as in their weight within weeks. And she also mentions the Blue Zone concept, Blue Zones, that's similar to Plant Pure Nation. Perhaps Wilmington could do something like that. Also, can we make our school lunch programs more plant-based? Education is key, starting with kids. That's a huge foot in the door, and Lisa happens to be a vegan chef. Thank you so much for that, Lisa. Yeah. What do you think about some of those, or do you know them,
those
programs?
I don't. I've heard of some of those where it's completely devoid of any meat product. One of the greatest things I think we have here is the partnership with the current school system administration that is really a strong partner in this childhood obesity, at least in the conversations that I've had so far, in how do we curb this generational problem with childhood obesity, because it does impact learning. It impacts a child's ability to earn a living wage later. So for me, it's about the partnerships and the relationships and the conversation and dialogue that's actually going to get us to that point. And I can tell you, Superintendent right now has that on his radar, so much so that he was that participant with us in this data collection expo that we had of saying, okay, these are the numbers we have. How do we move forward? So I think that's a huge step, is being able to pull these individuals together that can make a difference. And so I haven't heard of it, but at least we have a running dialogue. And I will tell you, we are doing obesity trending in the schools. So I wouldn't necessarily call it, but what we do is we have school nurses in our schools right now. And we've had a couple programs where not only are they doing nursing, but they're also doing some health and wellness, and we found some pretty good results with that. So, you know, it's being able to utilize the services, the sources we already have, and then being allowed to do it, and we do have that support from the schools. So,
what kinds of things specifically can some of those school nurses do?
So, right now, they can teach. They can take opportunities for diet education. They can take opportunities to. We had one school nurse that actually did the Girls on the Run. Getting them out and exercising. So they take as part of their and there's a whole curriculum around that, but it gets them not only doing that primary service provision, which is extremely important in the schools, which is a whole nother public health topic, but it gets them involved in other ways that not only supports our efforts, but it helps the school system as well, as they want this as successful as anyone else. So but it's them being active, it's teaching, it's instructing, it's going above and beyond just the medical clinic with these classroom settings of kids. We have, and I didn't bring them today, but we have some pretty good numbers that, while the BMI numbers might not have decreased dramatically or at all within a school, they didn't move up. And for us,
and that's positive.
That's positive because typically you see over the United States, you've seen BMI creep up. They didn't move. And that's the best. Stop the tide and start backing it up. And so we're starting to see some success with that. And my hope is that over the next, you know, this is a generational thing. I mean, we've talked about this in our small meetings. This is a generational issue. It's not something we're going to fix. You're not going to fix chronic disease in 5 years.
And is this also the first generation that will probably die before their parents?
Yeah, and actually, when you look at the statistics from county to county, I was looking at some stats here of years of life at birth. I think New Hanover County was at like 86, 85 or 86, somewhere in that range. If you just step 20 miles down the road into our neighbor Columbus County, it drops 6 years, age life expectancy. That's significant. So why is that? So we start thinking about, well, lifestyle choices and access and, you know, to some degree, personal responsibility does come into this, but you have to make those choices. But when you look at those numbers and you say, wow, you live 6 years longer here than you do there. Why is that? And those are the kind of things we start pairing out and saying, okay, what are the best practices here that we can take there, Brunswick, Pender, as a regional approach? Because we're not just Wilmington. I mean, we have, what, 40,000 people that drive into here to work every day, and they're taking those messages home. So we want to ensure that we take a collective approach.
You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. It's a conversation about public health today. What's killing North Carolinians prematurely? New Hanover County Health Director Philip Tart is with us. He's explaining and answering your questions on this Thursday. You can reach us today by calling us at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. Jeff from Tabor City, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Thank you.
You're welcome. What's your question or comment?
Well, I was listening to what you were saying about prevention with students and classrooms. And I work at an elementary school in Tabor City. We have an edible learning lab program that we've been doing for the past about 6 months, where we grow our own lettuce, tomatoes, and then we harvest it and have it in the cafeteria. And this is a good way for students to kind of learn about where their food comes from and making better health choices.
Is this something that you're doing in your own class? Is it something that you instituted, or are you doing this with other teachers?
Yeah, so we wrote a grant, and we received funding in January, which we started in our STEM lab, which is kind of like our science lab. So all of our students get to plant, you know, lettuce seeds and tomato seeds, and we're trying some other vegetables out as well. But, you know, they pretty much grow everything indoors in a hydroponic system. So
that's cool.
We can kind of control all the climate and everything to make sure that we have a good harvest. But
and Jeff,
it's been a really...
Do you see a difference in terms of how they react to the tomato that they grew versus a tomato that just might...
Yeah, absolutely. So we had our first harvest about a month ago, and we invited parents and community members to come out and have a salad with their kids. And, you know, when they got to actually taste what they grew, it really, kind of shocked them, because they didn't really, probably didn't eat that much lettuce or anything beforehand or have any salads. And, we noticed kind of an uptick in the chef's salad selection whenever we do have it available in our cafeteria.
Philip Tart?
Yeah, I just wanted to say I congratulate you on that. And I one thing he said is he invited and the parents to participate. That's a critical component to childhood education, and I commend you for doing that. And when you think of Tabor City, Tabor City is a rural community, and you still have kids that don't have – that don't eat that. I commend you for doing that. But yeah, parents are a critical component to this child's well-being, because they have to go home at the end of the day.
Jeff, thank you so much for sharing your story. Is that something that could come into New Hanover County schools? Are there schools in the public school system here that are growing their own food?
Not that I know of. I do know there are some components to having foods that are grown into the schools and GAP certifications with agriculture and those sorts of things, but it's certainly not impossible.
Okay, and we're not going to spend this whole hour on obesity and overweight, but you mentioned sedentary lifestyles as a big contributing factor to this and also to life expectancy. And another statistic, less than a third, and this might be from the self-reported pile, but less than a third of the new Hanover County population gets the recommended 30 minutes a day, 5 days a week of exercise. And this made me laugh, even though it's not funny. Most people report not liking exercise, it costs too much, or they're tired. So, amen. But what do you do?
Well, you know what? There are certain people, and I think we all realize that, that aren't going to. Whatever it is, they aren't going to. But that statistic is probably higher than that. I would give that some severe credibility. One thing we are doing, though, you do have what is becoming a very robust park system for this community.
And that's good for people who are inclined to get out and who want to do that.
And it costs them nothing.
So what do you do with the other folks? I mean, do you go around to their houses Gestapo-like and round them up and chase them around the neighborhood?
No. You just, you know what it is? It is that public awareness campaign of, you know, this is the benefits of your health. But you don't do it alone. You do it in collaboration with their primary care physician, with those schools, with that, you know, with their employer. You know, it's that health in all policies mentality. And so you don't go it alone. You go on it as a community. But I agree. We have a very robust and ever-increasing park system that that our county has taken part in, and I commend them for that.
Now, that said, the number one cause of death in New Hanover County is cancer.
Correct. And it's probably the number one cause of death statewide in almost every county that you'll see. And we'll still see that. We've been fighting that for years.
And we're going to take that apart when we come back. You're listening to Coastline. Health Director for New Hanover County, Philip Tart, is with us today. You can call us on this Thursday at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. You're listening to Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. We're talking today with the health director for New Hanover County, Philip Tart, learning about the major public health issues facing citizens, why poverty plays an outsized role in health. We're also finding out about behavioral changes that can have a big impact on longevity. And we're taking your questions on this Thursday. You can call us at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. Just before we went to break, Philip Tart, we'd spent all this time talking about being overweight and obese and how that contributes to chronic disease and premature death. And then you dropped this bomb that cancer is what's killing most of us.
Yeah, it's still the one of the leading causes of death, not only in North Carolina, but nationally. And a lot of that is behavior driven.
Really?
We talk about
cancer can be linked to behavioral.
Well, we'll take smoking, for example. Mm-hmm. You know, we still have a large contingency. I think North Carolina, about 20-25% of individuals who still smoke. So we still see these pockets of cancer. Obviously, there is some genetic. There's been new studies that came out in the past couple weeks that don't link it to genes. They just link it to your cell development. I'm not experienced enough in those, but we do know that a lot of the preventable cancers are behavior driven, tobacco being the number one that we see.
And that, of course, leads to lung cancer. Does that contribute to any other kind of cancer?
Well, they've had studies with the chemicals. Yeah. So you've got lung cancers, oral cancers, colon cancers, that still have a significant amount. You know, in the statistics we had here, you know, breast cancer still being very prevalent amongst females, and colon cancer rates are still high. And it's a matter of early detection, early screening. And when we talk about prevention earlier on, you know, prevention in people's minds is, well, I'm going to go get a screening for something. When I talk about prevention, I'm talking about not even it's us getting to the point to where we're prevention, like you're eating healthy, as Jeff talked about. It's prevention that I'm going to exercise enough. It's prevention that I'm not going to get in those behaviors, those binge drinking behaviors that could cause me problems later on, that drug use. It's those kind of prevention techniques, not necessarily. You still need the prevention-based diagnoses. We know that. But it's getting, when I talk prevention, it's more of before the fact, not let's get this and get this taken care of, although they're all important.
Of course. And I'm sure there are some people listening who say, well, I really like my donuts. And, you know, part of my quality of life is being able to enjoy my donuts. So get out of my donut box. I'm going to do this. And if it kills me early, that's my choice.
Yes. And I'm not going to sit here and tell you I don't like them either. Maybe a dose of insulin a little bit more. But the fact is, it's all about moderation. And this country, we talk about moderation. Yeah, enjoy the meal that you love or enjoy the activity you love. But it's all about the moderation. It's not something you want to do continuously. You've got to mix it up with healthy choices and healthy activities in order to combat that. Long term, yeah, you're going to continue to see this generation die sooner than the generation before.
And the deaths aren't going to be very pretty. I mean, part of this, too, when you talk about making that choice, is that your quality of life at the end of life can be pretty horrific for some.
It is. It's the quality of life. It's not the fact that I live to 90. It's how was my quality of life between 80 and 90? And that's important. Probably as important as living those long years. It's what's my quality. And so what do we do in the meantime to prevent those from happening? Yes, it's regular screenings. Yes, it's prevention activities. It's all those things that make us healthier.
Is there anything that do we understand more about breast cancer and prostate cancer? Because those seem to be two of the big ones when looking at causes of death in New Hanover County.
Well, one of the things I know that I noted in here and when we did our report out was that you notice a discrepancy when it comes to races. And those two, let's go back to screenings and early detection. Those, if you look at statistically, you have to draw inferences and you could draw conclusions. And again, this is where we get more in depth later on. But you have to infer that if you have a 3-time or a 4-time greater chance of dying from breast cancer as a black female, why is that? It's you know, we don't know that the incidence or the reason of developing breast cancers anymore in those races. We just know maybe this wasn't detected. Why is that? Well, let's talk about the social determinants. Let's talk about access to care. Let's talk about incomes. And that's not just for those two races, but it's for any discrepancy. That's what we want to look at. Why is this causal effect happening 5-fold, 10-fold for this set of the population versus this set of population?
Because we know now in New Hanover County, if I'm a black woman, I am more likely to die of breast cancer than if I'm a white woman.
Absolutely. That's what the numbers show us.
And from a public policy standpoint, how do you change that outcome?
I think for us, it's I'm going to beat this drum again. I think it's ensuring that we take the time collectively, decision makers that all have a part to play in this, pulling our resources together.
Who are some of the other decision makers in this?
Just think about public health 3.0, if you will, of getting community stakeholders. You've obviously got, I mean, for me in public health, we want to be that repository of information. We want to be that chief health strategist. We want to be able to pull all these data sets and put them in one place so we're all speaking the same language and, more importantly, agree that those are the stats we want to work on. You know, you've got county government, you've got a hospital system, very robust hospital system, you've got a school system, you've got economic development, you've got, you've got some of your community members, you've got your mayoral groups. It's all of those that are really involved in policy. And your industry, I think, is going to be key because we talk about health in all policies. We want them thinking, all right, how do I attract the best and brightest? I create the healthiest. It decreases my costs to have the healthiest workforce. But it also increases, you know, my productivity. And so we want them thinking about how do we make our client, I mean, our employees the healthiest they can be.
So employers,
in order to make us successful,
considering themselves stakeholders in that equation.
Absolutely. Because those, if I'm spending 10-15% of my income on health care that I should not have had to spend because of some decisions, that's the bottom. That's a bottom line. And it's continuity of operations. You want to make sure you're successful. So we think about that. It's business. It's industry. It's hospital system. It's public health. It's county government. It's everybody.
And
it's
Live
everybody.
Oak Bank,
it's
for
you.
Example,
yes.
Has a gym, I think, on the premises.
They do. And trying to get people to go to those, I mean, you can some might not. But, yeah, it's health in all policies. It's understanding. And it's programs like this where we talk about these issues and get people engaged.
We have an email from Beatrice. She says, I moved to Wilmington almost 2 years ago. And I like a lot about my new home, but my one complaint is the amount of driving I have to do. We live less than a mile from a grocery store, a park, my kids' schools, and my parents' house. But there's no sidewalk to any of these places, much less a suitable pedestrian walkway / bicycle path, safe for families. I'd like to see more interconnectivity for families who want to walk or ride bikes to their destination, not just for the individual adult cyclist who can ride in traffic.
Yeah, and we don't disagree. We had a meeting. We've been meeting with our local planning board and our planners, and we were talking about interconnectivity, walkability, bike, and there's a lot of that conversation that's taking place now, particularly in unincorporated areas that are quickly approaching, urban status. How do we create those environments where you connect people and create a healthier? And so that's taking place. As far as what's already existing, I think we continue to develop that. I think the county has a commitment to that and moving forward.
And we have another along those lines. Marjorie writes, I work for the YMCA of Southeastern North Carolina. Philip mentioned, in order to address these issues effectively, it has to be a community effort. Couldn't agree more. In fact, there are things we can do within our own place of work, faith communities, neighborhoods, to create healthier communities. For example, the Red Tablecloth Initiative encourages work sites or faith communities to place a red tablecloth on a table during potlucks to indicate where healthy food items are located. It's small, but it can mean a lot. Putting standards or policies in place are helpful, too. For example, why after-school programs have adopted healthy eating and physical activity standards. This ensures that every after-school site provides healthy snack options and at least 60 minutes of physical activity.
Couldn't agree more. And when you think about the why, here's a whole other set of folks that are dedicated to the betterment of the folks they serve. So, yes, they're a partner. They play a critical part in this game. But I do think it's about it's giving individuals the opportunities to make those decisions. But more importantly, it's taking the initiative to give that opportunity and participate.
And I do want to get to some of the substance abuse issues that this county has briefly. But first, let's talk with Ellen from Wilmington. Welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Well, thank you. I appreciate you having this program. My question was in regard to the possibility of there being cancer clusters in New Hanover County, being downwind of the industrial corridor on 421, especially in the area around the I-40 bypass. I travel a lot for my work, and I notice an acrid odor coming from that area. And also, depending on which way the wind is blowing, I can identify where the wind is coming from, depending on where I am in the county, if I can identify that smell. But I've tried to look into it before. I don't know if there's any documentation or research available on that. I have had cancer. I had a sister who had cancer. I survived. She did not. We both developed cancer after several years of from moving to Wilmington. We both were diagnosed with cancer within 3 or 4 years of moving to Wilmington. And I don't want to be alarmist, but I think it's a curiosity and something that I've been wondering about, if there could be any correlation or causation from being exposed to industrial chemicals in the air also.
Ellen, I'm so sorry for your loss. First of all, can I ask what kind of cancer you had, you and your sister?
I had breast cancer. I'm a 12-year survivor. My sister had pancreatic cancer. And I realize that they're totally different, but they both did develop within a few years of moving to Wilmington.
Philip Tart, any data on cancer clusters? Thank you so much for your question,
you.
Ellen.
So there are a couple of areas that catalog this data. CDC actually has some data on specific sets of information narrowed down to census tract data. The State Center for Health Statistics has some of that as well, but it's not where we want it to be. And I think she's exactly right. It's exactly what we're going to be working towards, is getting this down to population data. And the clean air we talked about earlier, yes, air, water, they can become potentials for, depending on what's in them, to harm you.
So even though we just got this wonderful ranking about Wilmington being one of the cleanest, having the cleanest air, the best air quality in the country, we still have some concerns.
Well, I don't know if we have concerns, but we have to stay on top of this clean air and make sure it continues. What I'm saying is that, yes, the chemicals monitored within air, the reason they're monitored is because they cause health issues. So you want to make sure they're not there. But the fact is that if we can cluster these and sort of determine, it's very difficult sometimes to determine causal effect. But if we have good data that shows that we are seeing clusters, it helps us more readily pinpoint and dedicate resources.
Very briefly, what is the difference between a drinking well and an irrigation well, since we're talking about air and water quality? And are there people in the county or geographic areas that you would be concerned about in terms of them being on well water and consuming that water?
So the difference, drinking water wells, obviously, as they say, are wells that are used for water consumption. Irrigation wells are, as you say, wells that are used for other sources that aren't drinking water. But the fact is they are typically drilled in the very same manner. For a public health perspective, there's still a conduit of potential contaminants down to the aquifer, as well as bringing up any arsenic, petroleum, those things that are in water tables below back up. So for us, they're one and the same. Doesn't matter what you call them, they're still an opportunity for somebody to drink. And we lived on a well for a very long time after I left home.
But that is a concern at this point. We don't have a really good handle on what's coming up and going down through people's wells.
So you don't. We have if you have a drinking water well, we do a test, and we will test your water for bacteria, for volatile chemicals, for nitrates, nitrites, et cetera, and we will give you that information. Right now, if you drill an irrigation well, it's not a regulated activity, so we really aren't testing that. But it's still potential to be utilized in that way.
I might drill an irrigation well and then use it for my drinking water? Is that what you mean?
I mean, you could. I mean, you obviously got a tap on it. You can drink that. The concern that we might have in public health and have had for a while is that you could be pulling contaminants that were at a, let's say you had an underground storage tank that might have been a five houses over. You don't know how that's leaching into that water table and pulling it over. So it's just a matter of having ideas of where they are, what's around them, who's drinking from them, just so they can be safe. It's not an intrusion. It's just ensuring that they're drinking safe water.
And that's this edition of Coastline. We'll have to save the impaired drivers for next time. Philip Tart, what a pleasure having you with us today. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coastline's executive producer is Cleve Callison. Producer is Isabel Shepherd. Technical director is Ken Campbell. Today's show was engineered by Caleb Covington. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at whqr.org. You can find the show on HQR's app or get the podcast. Tune in for the rebroadcast of this episode Sunday afternoon at 2. Join us for Coastline Live Wednesdays and Thursdays at noon here on HQR News 91.3 FM. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.